Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The USDA has halted shipments from its emergency food assistance program, leaving food banks like the Food Bank of Delaware scrambling to fill the void.
That's a big gap to fill. It's a big fat gap to fill, and not that we're not up for the challenge, but we didn't know that we had that challenge until 2 weeks ago.
We sit down with Food Bank of Delaware President and CEO Kathy Konevsky to discuss this issue. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Arts Playlist previews the City Theater Company's production of the ensemble comedy Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. And we bring you the first episode of the new Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Food banks across the country are facing mounting challenges, and the Food Bank of Delaware is no exception. The USDA's Emergency Food Assistance Program, a critical source of food assistance, has halted its scheduled shipments. That means fewer staples like fresh produce, dairy, protein, and shelf-stable items are making it to families in need. The president and CEO of the Food Bank of Delaware, Kathy Konevsky, recently wrote an op-ed about the urgency of this issue, warning that without action, food banks will struggle to keep up with demand. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with Konevsky to examine the implications of the USDA canceling food aid shipments and how it affects food insecurity here in the first state.
I understand that the Emergency Food Assistance Program made up more than a quarter of the food that the Food Bank of Delaware expected to receive for the rest of the year, and nearly 1 million meals that were expected to be delivered here are now canceled. What was your initial reaction to learning all of this? And I know this is affecting other food banks across the country, but as far as Delaware is concerned, can you give us a better sense of just how significant this move by the federal government is?
So we learned about the possibility of this halted delivery last week. And basically at that point, we were really hopeful still that the trucks were going to basically be turned around and released. And we're using the word halted on purpose because at that point they were not canceled. And so we were, as I said, we were hoping that that was going to change in a couple of days. And again, we've mentioned that this is not just the Food Bank of Delaware, it's all of our food bank colleagues across the country. And then sadly, at the beginning of the week, we did realize and heard the confirmation that it wasn't just halted. They were indeed canceled, and not just the 14 trucks that we originally thought, but 19. So that now 19 trucks that we were expecting to, have deliveries on that were coming to Delaware from the over the course of April through July, the beginning of July, end of June, we're not getting.
Well, looking at the response here, response might not be the apt word, but the Food Bank of Delaware is set to receive a little more than $27,000 in a donation from the restaurant slash company formerly known as Dunkin' Donuts, that now being just Dunkin', and specifically Dunkin' of Greater Philadelphia. And this week, Newark area members of the Delaware House Democrats teamed up with the Food Bank of Delaware to host a food and donation drive. Milford area state senators held a similar drive, but regardless of, if it's local or corporate help, and I know all help in this case, no matter what it looks like, is needed. But regardless, if it's local or if it's corporate, how many drives, would the food bank need to fill the gap? Like, how sustainable is, going back to all of these sources, considering the overwhelming need right now?
I will say that the bright spot, the glimmer, has been exactly what you just said. Dunkin' is one of four or five corporations that have stepped up. We've heard from, local municipalities, different counties. I mean, every entity that has the ability to say we want to help have been helping in the way that they can, whether that be doing food drives or providing cash sponsorship. And so on Tuesday, as you mentioned, we enjoyed a really great turnout from our Newark area legislators. They promoted a food drive, a food and fun drive, starting at 6 o'clock. A little before 5:30, cars started to line up. And it was a steady stream of cars coming and bringing food and bringing cash donations. And all of our legislators standing there with us, thanking everyone. And they were truly, part of the outreach and getting people there. Same thing in Milford. So Milford, we have a facility in Milford. Senator Wilson has been a longtime supporter of the food bank, and he actually we're in his district. So he kind of spearheaded along with a couple of other legislators in Milford, and we're expecting, to have the same kind of groundswell in other areas. As people are seeing other groups do something, we're getting five and six calls. Can we do something similar? So we've got on our website, go easily go to our fbd.org. The first thing you'll see is that we're really, rallying the community to help us fill this gap as much as we can. And we're seeing people that we've never had, as we've got 50 new donors within the last couple of days. We've got lots of folks signing up to be recurring donors, meaning that they're in for the long haul with us, which is just, it's been very heartwarming. But to answer your question about filling that gap, that's a big gap to fill. It's a big fat gap to fill. And not that we're not up for the challenge, but we didn't know that we had that challenge until 2 weeks ago. So on top of everything else that we're already doing, because a nonprofit like ours relies on a lot of donated energy, whatever that looks like, donated food, donated product, donated cash, and volunteers. And we really truly max that out already. So this was just kind of, okay, here's where we are. And we've been seeing numbers that are not anything lower than what we were seeing during COVID. People are the number of people coming to us now has not dropped. So our distribution hasn't kind of started to scale down like we thought it would. It's actually stayed steady because of the fact that food is more expensive for everybody right now. So it's really adding insult to injury for us.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, what food insecurity, what that picture looks like in Delaware right now. But as far as future food drives or events go, are there, I'm sure there aren't maybe set plans right now to hold more of those, whether it's food drives, donation drives, other events, whatever. But is that something I'm guessing the Food Bank of Delaware would like to do or hold or just a further.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we just today we heard from a school that has not ever participated before, and they want to do a food drive. If anyone is interested in doing that kind of thing with us, the answer is yes, first of all. And the way to get in touch with us is really truly through our website. And we've got a team of folks that are ready and waiting to just team up and make it happen.
And how does, as far as the Food Bank of Delaware's like operations go, how does having to deal with this issue, how does that affect like other areas of the food bank's like entire operation?
That's a great question. So we, I've worked for, I'm not young. I've worked a lot of places. I've been around the block a few times, as they say. I don't know that I've ever worked with a team of people that are just so nimble and flexible and willing to roll up their sleeves and do whatever needs to be done. I shared a story, somewhere along the line a couple of weeks ago, and someone picked up on it. So I keep sharing the same story. I was in a at a conference, and the president and CEO of Feeding America said, "I get to do this work." It was her whole story, but her point was, I get to do this work, not I have to. I don't have to go to work. I get to go to work. And it has flipped at least my perspective to say, boy, in this, especially right now when people need us so drastically and so desperately, it's an honor, quite honestly, to actually have the opportunity to serve. So when we figure out, that there are 10 more drives that we need to staff, we just do it. We do it because that's what's needed.
And I did say I was going to ask about this and that you answered the question, but just as far as maybe the data or maybe just giving us more insight into what food insecurity looks like in Delaware, what that need looks like.
Yeah, sure. So 1 in 8 Delawareans is hungry. Is food insecure, and food insecurity is defined as not having enough food to thrive and survive. So it doesn't mean like, you're cutting back and maybe you're not going to order pizza on a Friday night, but you still have your three meals a day and you're not really, I mean, not having the proper food to nourish your body and going to bed hungry and waking up hungry. 1 in 8 in Delaware and 1 in 5 children. And I think that's the one that, for most people, I can't imagine somebody that doesn't touch to think about a child.
In terms of the ripple effect here, and you touched on this in your first answer, but as far as the ripple effect here goes of what the federal government has decided to do, what does that, how does this affect like schools, like maybe partnerships you have with schools, things like that, other entities? What does that ripple effect, I guess, kind of look like?
So what we're doing right now, and we spend, so you asked how it's impacting other things that we're serving. I don't, since my time here, and I've been here almost 4 years, we've never spent so much time looking at our budget and reassessing our budget and creating pivots in case we don't get this funding. How are we going to do this? And prioritizing which programs we are able to do. If status quo, this is what we do, but if we have to really drastically cut, what programs are we going to have to cut? We do home delivery right now for people that can't get to a pantry, and that's one of our more expensive, ways to get food to somebody. So we're constantly reassessing how we're going to be able to get food out, but at the same time, to whom? Right. So everybody, like I said, children, 1 in 5 children. One of the ways that we serve children throughout the state is through our backpack program. So we partner with schools and the schools identify the children and we get backpack kits. They're not backpacks. They're not going home with a backpack that says, hey, I got my food from the food bank. Food bank food is going very discreetly into their own backpack. So they're going home with food for the weekend because some kids don't eat unless they're in school. So that's one program that we're, truly prioritizing. And that one is by far the one that we get the most private funding for. So we're talking to our funders, we're talking to our donors, and we're making sure that we continue. But that said, that means the other programs come, funding comes from a variety of sources, whether or not it's, our local corporate community who already sponsors us, but our federal government and our state government. So if those programs continue to go away and that food continues to dwindle, it's going to affect all of our programs and all of our ability to get food to people.
Thanks to Food Bank of Delaware President and CEO Kathy Kineski and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, we head to the City Theater Company in Wilmington to preview their production of the ensemble comedy Vanya and Sonya and Masha and Spike. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The City Theater Company in Wilmington is bringing comedy to the stage with its latest production, Vanya and Sonya and Masha and Spike. The Tony Award-winning play by Christopher Durang puts a modern comedic spin on classic Chekhov characters, following three middle-aged siblings whose quiet life is upended by a surprise visit. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny catches up with the play's director, Joseph Pukach, and the City Theater Company's artistic director, Curry Christine McElrone, who's playing Masha, to explore the ways the company is bringing this sharp-edged production to life.
Let me start by asking you a little bit about this play and what's the story it's telling.
So the main story is about basically three siblings, brother and two sisters. One sister's adopted. And the two of them live together in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The older sister, or the other sister, is basically a movie star, and she's coming back home for sort of a surprise visit to let them know that she is selling the house. She's basically been supporting them and has reached a place in her life where she doesn't want to do that anymore. So you get a lot of sibling rivalry, you get a lot of old wounds being ripped open, and it's the comedy. So it's all played very humorously, but there's also a lot of heart. There's some tears for sure. It's not a wacky comedy. It's definitely a little more cerebral. You have your overwhelming sense of Chekhov kind of watching over all this, and we know that he was a very deep, dark guy. The comedy comes out of a lot of different places, and it definitely can come out of drama and pain. And I think this play does a really nice job of mining all of that and making it entertaining still.
Carrie, you play Masha. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your impressions of the play and also something about your character.
Sure. City theater has a long history with doing Durang, and I've been in two of the ones that we've done. So I kind of love Durang. I feel like I grew up, cut my teeth on some Durang. For this character, and I think all of these characters, there's a lot about like aging that kind of goes hand in hand with that technology. So you have people who are essentially middle-aged, and they're no longer in their first or even second flush of youth. And then, like, what does that mean? So for this character, who is in a very superficial Hollywood world, and the way she kind of speaks, and the actions she's going to take that are very lonely, and very like about kind of what it means to be a woman in that environment. That's obviously something I've been in for my whole life. So it's pretty with doing theater. So it's so that stuff's very interesting to kind of plumb and think about, and how you use that to like inform the character. And from a city theater standpoint, like I said, we've done a few Durangs, and it's very city theater because we don't tend to do like your kind of easy comedies. When we do comedies, we're usually doing ones that have some oomph behind them, some depth. And with Durang, they're usually kind of dark comedies. Durang was significantly older when he wrote this one, and it was, I believe, his last play. And I think that's reflected in there too. It's like all this kind of, keeping the humor, but then there is a lot of heart. And I do think in his plays, ultimately, there is a lot of heart, because a lot of them are about family, or just relationships, and kind of how people deal with all of the everyday absurdities that we deal with. And from like your very heavy things that happen to just the mundane. Like in this play, there, it opens with an argument over a cup of coffee from the same coffee maker that is somehow different, one cup from the other. There's no reason for it to be different. It kind of sets off, where we're going with this play, of the kind of yin and yang between like silly things that then become like this big blow up, and then, right back into, but it's okay because we're looking out the window and we hope the blue heron comes. So it's, I love it. It's really fun, and getting to, really plumb that with our particular cast of actors, who are all very, very talented and have a lot of thoughts and have a lot of ideas and are doing their homework, is a joy.
In this play, it seems to me the complexity of the relationships is a big part of the story. So, as an actor, how do you prepare for that? And as a director, how do you put the cast into that space?
Well, we were actually talking about this yesterday. The main thing with comedy is you don't want to play it for the comedy, because then, it's, you try too hard, the audience knows you're trying too hard. And if you just let the realness of the characters come out, and people will recognize that in that, themselves in those moments, it works so much better. They say things that you're just like, yeah, that's my family. That's definitely something that my dad would have said, or my sister would have said. And now you have this like tableau of six different people all contributing to that and having the little weird senses of humor. I mean, Carrie's character is a great example. Like, she comes in like a tornado and is just disrupting these siblings' lives that are so simple. And like she said, they just sit in front of the window and they watch the pond and they do this. But it's done with such subtle comedy.
Yeah, all the characters being ground in, who they are, and solid in who they are as these people, because I think that they're very real people. And it's great. It's so great to have these sort of ta these very talented people who understand the assignment, as it were, that know to kind of dig in, know what they can pull in without without it. And then I think the challenge, of course, is the comedy, right? And it's not heavy, and that it is clearly a comedy that you are, that you're signaling early on. In one of the interviews I read with the original cast on Broadway, they one of them spoke about that, about kind of how like how you let people know that it's okay to laugh, because that can be the trick sometimes with comedies like this. It's just kind of like it's like a slice of life, I guess, really, which is what really good theater should be. And you're just literally getting a window into these into a weekend in this particular group of six people's lives. And as an actor, that's just always amazing.
Sonia and Vanya and Masha, probably names familiar to people who are familiar with the work of the dramatist Anton Chekhov. Talk about the connection to the plays of Chekhov in this piece.
It's neat. In the back of the script, Durang actually kind of breaks down his experiences with Chekhov and then where he kind of pulled these characters from. I mean, they literally are named after Chekhov characters. In the story, their parents were they worked at community theater, so they were scholars, and so they lived that world and decided to name their kids literally Chekhov characters. You're not getting a Chekhov history when you watch this. It's definitely not like some dry thing like that. But if anybody who has read, you know, The Seagull, they reference The Seagull, the Three Sisters. I mean, it's you get those little kind of like, you know, Easter eggs, I guess you'd call them now. It's not going to be inaccessible to people who don't know it.
Yeah, Durang made a big point about that. And kind of like Joe said, they are a little bit of Easter eggs. And I'm still like finding them and discovering them. Where like you'll say a line and you'll be like, oh, that's from, you know, right. I forgot about that because I read that in, you know, college 900 years ago and it didn't stick. So it's definitely, you know, it the tongue kind of firmly in cheek about what it is. And I think overall with Chekhov and a lot of those in a lot of his like more famous plays, like Uncle Vanya and the Three Sisters and Cherry Orchard, Seagull, it's just people sitting in a room talking. And you don't need to be well versed in Chekhov and an academic or an actor or anything like that to kind of get the impact, I think, of those references, because he plays fast and loose with all of it. You know, it's not consistent, but that overall theme of, you know, we start the play with two people that sit in a room, and there are and the two characters in the play that are not, you know, anywhere in Chekhov are Cassandra, who's the housekeeper, who is just named, you know, for mythology, Cassandra, and just constantly is coming in with these crazy Greek chorus like doom and gloom prophecies that she has because she is psychic and all this kind of stuff. And again, and it's just, it's kind of, you know, it's just fun. It's just a fun little take, but then her predictions start to happen or come true, or they've already happened. So, you know, you get a lot of humor. And then the character of Spike, clearly there is no Spike in a Chekhov play because that is a very modern name, right? And so I think there's a little bit of that too, of like having kind of these two outsiders and the neighbor Nina, who is named after a Chekhov character, you know, three against three coming in and disrupting this like structure because they're sort of outside of the family unit of the traditional Chekhov of a bunch of people sitting around talking about what they might go do and then not going to do it. And these three kind of force, I think, some things to happen, you know, subtly or directly in the choices that these other characters make.
Thanks to the City Theatre Company's Artistic Director, Carrie Christine McElrone, Director Joseph Pukach, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. The City Theatre Company's production of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike runs through April 12th. Visit the Greens page on DelawarePublic.org for more information. And we wrap up the Green next with the first episode of the new Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This week, we bring you the first episode of the new Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet. The podcast explores how Delawareans connect to the environments and cultures around them and the cultural practices and creative works that bring us closer to the planet we call home. In this first episode, the focus is on the history and significance of agriculture in Delaware and its place in today's world. Egg Key, former Delaware Department of Agriculture Secretary, joins the episode to discuss the deep roots of agriculture in Delaware and what the future holds for the state's agricultural industry. When we talk about where it all began for Delaware in terms of farming and agriculture, what are we talking about, Ed? What are kind of the earliest roots of ag in Delaware?
Well, the earliest roots really go back to 1631 with the settlement at Lewis with the Dutch, and then later on in Newcastle and eventually Wilmington. That was the colonial, very early colonial stage. But by the 1740s, and this region, not only Delaware, but northern eastern shore of Maryland, southeast Pennsylvania, was great for wheat. And the Brandywine River, because it had that terrific waterfall that, you know, drives grain mills, really became the center of grain milling, transforming wheat into flour and other crops as well. And that's in the 1740s when that really starts to show up in Wilmington on the river. By the Revolutionary War, Delaware mill owners were exporting wheat and barley, other crops, to the Caribbean, to Western Europe, and even to the Mediterranean. So we go way back in beginning, and it's quite something.
What were some of the biggest shifts in Delaware when it comes to farming and ag? Things that over the course of years between what we just talked about and even present day, that kind of changed the trajectory significantly, whether due to technology, policy, economic factors, were there some kind of mileposts where, like, this is where Delaware hit a fork in the road and went this way instead of that way?
It's a great question. So in move up to the before the Civil War in the 1850s, the first cannery in Delaware was in Dover in 1855, and that was the Richards and Robinson Canning Company, which is now the office building that houses Denrick, our state agency. And then the railroad was completed in 1859. So now Southern Delaware is really open and has a good connection to markets. Via the railroad, they could ship produce, you know, fresh vegetables and fruit, as well as grain and flour, but vegetables and fruit to Philadelphia, to New York, to urban markets. And that was a big deal. Now, just in that same era, maybe a little bit earlier, 1832, was a man named Philip Rodbolt, and planted the first budded peach orchard over near Delaware City on the site. A budded orchard meant all the varieties could be the same. They weren't random. So they could have a critical mass, and they could identify different varieties of maturity. So they had peaches maturing not only in 1 week, but maybe through a month and a half. And those peaches were shipped by water, on the Delaware River up to Philadelphia. So from the beginning, we were kind of an entrepreneurial group. So now you had ocean traffic followed up by the railroad connecting. And 1855, as I said, was the first cannery. That takes us to through the 1900s. We have railroad. We still have some water transportation, which includes the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal. And then in 1916, and it was completed in 1923, the DuPont Highway that T. Coleman DuPont financed personally, and then gave that to the state.
Was there a point, Ed, where we started to really see what we can kind of consider the modern Delaware agriculture economy come into full view?
Yeah. So, you know, the chicken industry gets started in 1923, and it grows quickly. And the people in that part of Sussex County really grabbed on because they needed to a source of income. So it grew aggressively and spread over into Maryland. But the real change to modern agriculture really begins after World War II. We had vets coming back from the service and taking advantage of the GI Bill. So, you know, they could go to college if they so choose. They all got $20 a month. But there was energy that came into the state And the poultry industry really grew even quicker from, say, 1950 till today. Now, concurrent with that, what do chickens eat? Well, they eat corn and they get their protein from soybeans. So farming changed from a lot of the hand harvest crops, whether it was fresh market or vegetables, and the mechanization into the grain crops facilitated a farmer could generate income. Perhaps he had chickens as well, perhaps not, but growing corn, soybean, wheat, and barley, and selling that a lot, especially the corn and the soybeans, to the poultry industry. So you have this three-legged stool of the poultry industry being fed by the corn and soybeans that, that farmers grow. And up until the late 60s, the poultry industry pretty much, and there were a lot of national companies, meat companies like Swift and Armour that were operating here, but the industry moved towards vertical integration. And by 1960s, you had companies that ran the hatcheries, actually ran the breeding program where the birds were in the hatchery. Then the hatchery produced the young chicks for all the farmers to grow. Then the companies are doing the processing part and the marketing. So it's totally vertically integrated. And that brings the phenomenon of Frank Ledoux, who his company was started in Maryland, but a large presence in Delaware today. In fact, that company has more employees in Delaware than has in Maryland. But he was the one who did the advertising in the New York and Boston market and really revolutionized poultry marketing and solidified the importance of that industry in our region and in our state. You'll recall he was the man that says it takes a tough man to take to make a dead chicken. And so from World War II on, we have hybrid corn, we have a growing poultry industry. We still have a significant vegetable industry, shipping watermelons and sweet corn, fresh market up and down the East Coast to chain stores. We have a really neat phenomenon of farmers from Long Island being pushed out of Long Island by the rapid development of housing out there. And so we had over 60 Long Island farm families migrate to Delaware from about 1945 to 1955. They were great potato growers, and most of them settled in Kent County, Dover and Smyrna area, some in Middletown. And that really brought a unique aspect into Delaware agriculture as well, because there's one true story. A Delaware farmer saw this crop growing in a Long Island farmer's field in Delaware, and he didn't know what it was, and he thought it was tobacco. It turned out it was cauliflower. So there was some cultural things that came with that, and wonderful families, dedicated farm families. The other thing since the end of World War II was the science and technology of crop production. We had brand new molecules, new chemistry that would control fungus diseases, control insects, control weeds, and that really made a difference. So farmers could be more efficient with the mechanization and the new chemistries that have evolved and changed over the years, but still a force in what farmers do. And then the other big thing is irrigation. So I graduated from the University of Delaware in agriculture in 1973. And the census says there was about 21,000 acres of irrigated farmland in Delaware. Most of that is with aluminum pipe that kids like me would move across the field and irrigate the field. Today, we've gone from 21,000 to about 175,000 acres of irrigated land. 90% of that are the center pivot systems that we see when we ride down country roads. And that has been a huge asset. So and technology of the chemicals, of fertilizer use, you know, everything else, transportation, irrigation, a growing pulp industry, and still a vibrant, it's smaller, but a vibrant fresh market and processing crops, processing vegetable crops as well. So we still have probably about 40,000 acres of vegetables that are grown either for canning, freezing, or as a fresh product.
So we come to today now, and talk to me a little bit about kind of sustaining this industry. We hear a lot about sustainable farming in the current day. You know, can you tell us a little bit about what that is, what that means, what kind of impact it has on Delaware's agricultural landscape?
Yeah, it's sustainable. There's a lot of definitions that are pegged to sustainability. But my version of it is has two phases. The one phase is proper farming practices, appropriate applications, developing new approaches, you know, for a healthier soil that can be fertile without, you know, burning itself up through overuse. Mm-hmm. And so sustainable practices have to relate to profit. You can't separate sustainable and profitable. And you know, every business has to be sustainable by making money and making a profit. And fortunately, we have enough diversity, and especially with the irrigation, which we are blessed with plentiful aquifers that to keep all that going. But the other piece of sustainability, and it's especially filled with some anxiety here in Sussex County, and that's the incredible real estate development that's going on in rural Sussex County. And it's important to know that these aren't necessarily farmers who are selling the land. These are descendants, maybe three or four generations away from the farmer on that particular farm. Or they may have been investors over the years. A farm would come up to sale. Now, there are some farmers that are retiring, and that's their retirement package, frankly. Mm-hmm. But so I live in northern Sussex County on a farm near the little village of Lincoln. And there's developments all around my farm and going down to the East Coast. So consequently, you wonder, gee whiz, can we still support the poultry industry? Can we still have a vibrant, viable agriculture where the supply side has enough market to sell the fertilizer, the seed, the tractors, the trucks? And, you know, is that nucleus going to be here? And that's when very quickly Delaware agriculture becomes a part of Delmarva agriculture, and it all kind of comes together. So back in the 1850s, there was a group of Marylanders that wanted to succeed from Maryland and join Delaware, but they didn't get very far.
In a program that Delaware started, the Century Farm Program, which actually kind of highlights some of these long-term family farms and kind of boosts that kind of concept. Can you tell us a little bit about how that program kind of connects this greater idea of maintaining family farms?
It's basically a recognition and appreciation program where the state, and specifically the Department of Agriculture, helps farmers do the deed search. And if it has been in the same family for 100 years, you're recognized as a century farm. There was one in particular that went back to 1684, and it was a land grant from the William Penn himself. again, it's all about between the Ag Land Preservation Program and the Century Farming Program. It's a recognition by the state and the citizens of the state of Delaware that agriculture is important to our state, and we appreciate it.
How important, Ed, are farmers markets in this equation as well? They've grown substantially in recent years. How much do they also kind of play a role in kind of making these family farms sustainable by giving them that type of market to tap into?
That has been a really growing thing. You know, for years, the King Street Market in Wilmington was a big deal twice a week. And then with grocery stores and just society changing, got away from that. But back in 2006 is the year I want to mention. That's when the Lewis market started. Yep. And it just hit a chord. And other towns have done the same thing. And So here's why they're important. They are a market that certain larger farmers are engaged in, and it might be surprising, you know, why is a farm that's growing 2,000 acres and has roadside or farm markets on their property, why do they participate? Well, because, you know, it's another good sales opportunity, frankly. So, but what's really been helpful is a large number of small farmers have participated. Some of these are part-time farmers. Some of these are the son and daughter of large farmer that have carved out their niche in one special crop or another. And so it's opened the door for small farmers. There are great farmers markets up and down the state now. But besides selling fresh produce, fresh, healthy vegetables and fruit, the other thing it does, which is really positive, is it gets farmers talking to consumers and consumers talking to farmers, and they listen to each other. And you can just tell the person that comes up to a booth at a farmer's market, they are just really pleased the farmer is there to explain the crop. I have one very good friend who thinks he's the greatest person of determining when cantaloupes are ripe. And so I visit with him, and whenever I tell his customers, I was the one that taught him how to do it. So you get a lot of fun. It's become a very important part of Delaware's agricultural fabric. And there's real money being made. I mean, it isn't millionaires, but it is income to the family, whether they're part of an existing farm or they have a small garden or somewhere between. The economic impact is real. I think Lewis cracked the $1 million mark in sales just last year, which is really terrific.
You mentioned at one point kind of sons and daughters of farmers, and I'm curious, what are we seeing from young people in farming? Are younger generations showing an interest to kind of maintain and sustain these things that we're talking about?
I think the youth is there. It's hard for anybody to get started from scratch.
Right.
And I've been around this for 50 plus years now, and there are some great stories. At the University of Delaware College of Agriculture, 70% of the students are women. And that is a trend that's going all across the country. And when I went to school, there were maybe two or three women in our class, in our individual class. And now, you know, the majority are young women who are smart. They're aggressive. They're not afraid of trying new things. They're not afraid of getting out in a lab with livestock and learning how to do that. So that's kind of exciting. And I think the other thing that draws women, a large percentage of those female students across the country are interested in veterinary science, or certainly animal science in general.
I was going to say, there has been a pretty concerted effort, not only at the university level, but even down into the high school level, to connect students to ag sciences. Do you feel like that's also kind of played a role in kind of keeping the young people interested and again, attracting more women into it?
It absolutely has. The vocational agriculture programs and the Future Farmers of America, which is, you know, connected to the vocational ag. First of all, Delaware has an outstanding program in high schools and middle schools up and down the state. At the college level, every year, there are about 30,000 graduates with a four-year Bachelor of Science degree in one discipline or the other of agriculture. 30,000 graduates each year, and there's about 60,000 jobs. So if you're a non-farm family and you have a child that's interested in science or economics, you know, stop on down to the ag school, because that's where 4 years, mom and dad will be happy. All that tuition is paying off into a lucrative job. I don't want to sound too enthusiastic, but I'm as excited about agriculture today as I did when I was 20 years old.
I want to jump back to preservation and conservation for a moment. Can you talk a little bit about how farmland preservation is tied to kind of broader land conservation efforts and how they kind of work hand in hand to really boost open space, essentially, in the state of Delaware?
Well, yes. It's important to note that the Delaware Ag Land Preservation Program is not necessarily a tool to influence development and where that happens. It is significantly and primarily the tool to preserve farmland. That's the deal. All this development that's happening, you know, is it a repeat of Newcastle County? Northern Newcastle County used to be dairy farms, dairy farms, dairy farms. Now that's all gone. And is that what we're doing down in the southern part of the state? So the state needs to ask that question and then to see what can be done about it. And it gets down to resources. You know, you build new houses, then you have to have more schools, more highways, you know, more services to provide. I think we're at a point where the leadership of the state, and I see this starting to emerge at the local level and perhaps the state level, starting to ask questions about this. And because it's not only about the economic impact of agriculture, it's the quality of life, you know, open space, wildlife habitat, you know, it's all connected.
I was going to say, I mean, how much does that farmland and overall preservation fit into the concept of, say, like climate resiliency, right? That, you know, that, you know, that there is some need to maintain, as you mentioned, kind of ecosystems and habitats and things like that.
All habitats, conservation areas, whatever you want to call them, districts, you know, they're all interrelated with so many issues, but it boils down to quality of life, quality of the goods and the services, really, the state of Delaware offers to its citizens. I would contend that a strong, healthy agricultural industry with plenty of open space for farms is an incredible asset, not only economically, but again, the quality of life. Everybody wants to live at the beach right now, and I wave to them as they go by.
On the topic of agriculture and climate change, are there some climate related threats you worry about when it comes to farming and agriculture in Delaware?
You know, it's really interesting. You can tell farmers work outdoors. I haven't met a farmer yet in the last 10 years that doesn't believe in climate change. I mean, they see it, they live with it, they deal with it. And one of the things are more violent storms. But the other thing, right now, we're in a very dry time. The other one is saltwater intrusion, mm-hmm. which, you know, we've seen it when we've had a big northeast storm coming across the Delaware Bay and hitting the Fowler Beach, Broadkill, Slaughter Beach area, the farms that are inland from that, right on the border of the wetlands and the farmland, there's been some saltwater intrusion. Lots of big issues, and I think we have leadership at the state level, both in the executive and the legislative branch, that are beginning to think about this stuff seriously. And the question is, what will Delaware be like 25 years from now?
As you think about the future of farming and agriculture in Delaware, what do you see in 10, 15, 20, 25 years? What do you see as the path forward for ag in Delaware?
I think the path forward is making sure our poultry industry is alive and well, and managing the poultry manure. Tremendous improvements in our management and use of poultry manure, where it used to be a disposal problem. Now it's seen by farmers as an economic source of nutrients for their crops. Appropriate farm practices for our poultry industry and our crop growing industry will get us there, making sure that the tax burden, whether it's property tax or other taxes, are not interfering. I mean, farmers may grumble about their taxes, but they realize it's, you know, every citizen has to pay their taxes and so forth, but make sure it's not skewed against them unfairly in any kind of way.
You've been listening to the Delaware Humanities podcast, People and Planet, with former Delaware Department of Agriculture Secretary Ed Key's discussion of the history and significance of agriculture in Delaware. The full podcast is available at DelawarePublic.org and DEHumanities.org. People and Planet is brought to you by Delaware Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Green. The stories, interviews, and podcasts you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, the staff at Delaware Humanities, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.